speak up about that. We do it internally, we do it externally.
Yeah.
Good, excellent, good. We have to start now? Okay. Good, excellent. Thank you very much for joining this session. Can I ask for the first question? Over there. I'll get back to you then.
Thank you. Vincent Meunier from Morgan Stanley. So I have two questions, please. The first one is on 2017. Can you elaborate on the expected off-label use of Perjeta in case of success of Affinity, if you can quantify that? And also the timing in your guidance for the biosimilar launches for Rituxan and MabThera. And the second question is a follow-up to your comments on the margins evolution, the profitability evolution of the group in case of negative results for Affinity. In your guidance, you assume that there will be, I mean, no material margin impact. But when we think about 18 and beyond, is it possible to quantify a bit, or what will be for you really the approach? Will it be more in absolute terms or as a percentage of sales? Thank you.
Okay. So let's start with off-label use Perjeta. Now, very unlikely to happen in Europe. As you know, this is highly linked to reimbursement, and there is hardly any off-label use in Europe. In the US, I would say it depends on the data. I mean, if you have stunning data, which really make a huge difference for patients. I mean, I can well imagine that that physicians adopt the you know new treatment regimes. If it's less differentiated, I guess there will be much less of an impact. So I would say this depends on the data. I see more of an impact for the neoadjuvant setting. So let's assume, just for the sake of discussion, that there would be a detrimental effect from Affinity. So kind of combining Perjeta and Herceptin delivers worse results than you would see with Herceptin alone. Then, of course, that would have an impact, certainly, on the neoadjuvant setting. So the short answer, it depends. It depends on the data.
Just a quick follow-up on that one. What is the difference for you in terms of p-value between astonishing and less differentiated? Would it be 0.8 or 0.7?
Yeah, I think we don't guide for that publicly. You know, I'm tempted to give you the hazard ratio here, but what you can rely on is that we have, targeted the profile in a way that it's meaningful. So if it's differentiated, it's not only a mathematical differentiation; it's a cleaningful, meaningful differentiation. Good. The second question was timing of biosimilars. Now, we expect biosimilars this year for both MabThera and Herceptin in Europe. The impact is more likely to be in the second half of this year. And obviously, we will have the full year impact then as we go into 2018. So from all what we know now, there is probably a more limited impact in the first half of this year. Margin evolution, well, there is really a lot going on at the moment in terms of launches, in terms of our own clinical trials, and of course, clinical trials being done by the competition, in particular in cancer immunotherapies. So really, if you play through the scenarios, and we do that for business plan purposes, you can come to very different scenarios, as you can imagine. If everything reads out positively, You know, think of a lampalizumab. Think of Tecentriq being competitively differentiated. Think of hemophilia. Then, of course, that gives you room for margin expansion, obviously. On the other hand, let's take the other extreme example. All of these studies read out negatively. Then, of course, we have erosion on the maturing products, and that puts margins under pressure. It's a bit the nature of our business that would happen. But I'm very hesitant to give you here a guidance beyond 2017, because there are so many balls in the air. And there are so many potential scenarios. Now, you know, I'm looking at the data we've had so far. I'm looking at the data which read out in 2016. So I have a positive attitude. It's much more de-risked today than it was a year ago. But nevertheless, I'd still be careful to see how it plays out. Right. And that was it, I think. Can we move to the next question over there, and then we switch to that side?
So I'm this Keyur Parekh from Goldman's, and I've got three kind of big picture questions. I'm not looking for guidance, but if you kind of draw a picture for us for Roche over the next 5 years, right? I mean, in a sense, 2017 is probably as good as it is going to get, because you still have limited biosimilar competition. 2018, 19, will have full year impact in Europe. 19 and 20 and beyond, you'll have US impact at some level. So should we all think about, if the pipeline comes through as you expect it to come through, should we think of Roche doing low to mid single digit? Is that kind of a ball case, base case scenario we should think about? The second one, and I think you kind of answered this just a minute back, but specifically as it relates to cancer immunotherapy, are you more excited about it today than you were 12 months back, broadly speaking, across the industry? Because the financial markets would suggest that's not the case. And secondly, about Roche's position within cancer immunotherapy.
Okay.
And then I have a question for Alan, which I'll come back to.
So let me start with the longer term outlook. I mean, certainly over, say, the next 3 years or so, we will see the impact of the biosimilars, as you have outlined in Europe, and then later on in the United States. And here you will have an offsetting effect. I mean, at the end of the day, there is a lot of our turnover on stake here with Avastin, Herceptin, and MabThera in particular. And we work against that. If you look beyond that time frame, then of course at some point this has washed out, you know, the patent life of the various launches which are underway at the very moment, that actually gives us a lot of growth potential in the outer years, depending on the readout of the pipeline. So I would say for the shorter term, we will have more of an offsetting effect here, and we have to manage through that erosion of the biosimilars. In the longer term, if we look at the various scenarios and our own business plans, there's actually quite some upside potential here, because if you have washed out so much and then you have a portfolio which still has a long runway, you can imagine that can give quite an impulse. But of course, the prerequisite for that is a positive readout of at least a number of the studies we'll see coming up. So midterm offsetting effects, longer term, depending on the readouts, quite some upside potential. That's how I would characterize it. On the cancer immunotherapies, I have to say, if I look at the early data which I see coming out of GRED, of PRED, and you know, I have to be careful, this is very small patient numbers, but if I see the impact which we have with some of those molecules for some patients, I mean, this is really game changing. And you know, not all of the data will be confirmed in pivotal trials. There will probably be some kind of need for stratification of patients. But there's just no doubt anymore from a scientific and from a medical point of view. This is really, really exciting. And that's why we keep investing and actually keep increasing our resources we allocate for cancer immunotherapies. So I, for me personally, I would say I got more excited over time. And I'm certainly also more excited than I was 12 months ago.
And then lastly, Alan, congratulations. You managed to stay just above the 0 to 15% net debt to assets ratio. So presumably we shouldn't be asking a question on capital allocation. But as you look at asset pricing kind of from an M&A perspective, and I know, Severin, you've mentioned previously, kind of you think they're not justifiable. And then you look at 30 billion or 31 billion for your neighbors. What do you do with cash?
Right. Let's go through the various options here. I mean, part of it is reinvesting into our business, of course. We do that. We continue to do that. I mean, our growth strategy is primarily based on driving our own science, our own pipeline. That's part of it. M&A... I mean, we keep watching for opportunities, both in diagnostics and in pharma. Our strategy as such has not changed. We look for bolt-on acquisitions to complement with interesting technologies, in particular in diagnostics, or assets for pharma. But the reality is, and you have alluded to it, prices are extremely high. Opportunities are scarce to start with. Prices are very high, especially for later stage assets. And as a result of it, you know, we basically didn't do any acquisition over the more recent past. So this can always change because we keep looking, and at some point, an opportunity might come up, but it's you know, there's nothing on the horizon. So then the question is, what happens over time as we run down our debt? You know, for us, we have done this in the past. The obvious way is then dividends, and that's how we, you know, can easily optimize the balance sheet. You remember we had this phase 10 years ago when we accumulated a lot of cash due to the success of some of the oncology products such as Herceptin and Avastin. And what we did as a result of that is we increased our payout ratio, and we brought cash back to the shareholders via dividends. So should we come into a situation like this in the mid or longer term, I think we will find solutions to return the cash to shareholders if necessary. Right. Shall we switch here first, and then I'll get back here. Thank you.
Joe Walton from Credit Suisse. A few P&L related questions, if we could.
Sure.
You're spending about or over a billion in restructuring, and you say that will help your gross margin. But against that, we've obviously got the impact of biosimilars. So I'm wondering if you could help us model gross margin overall going forward. Should we just assume that R&D expense will more or less offset, the restructuring charge benefits will more or less offset what we would see would be the natural decline otherwise, so that we could keep a broad gross margin?
This would be wonderful if you could offset the pricing pressure from biosimilars with manufacturing efficiencies. I tell you, this is not possible. No way whatsoever. And the reason is that if you look at the cost for biologics, they are relatively small relative to sales. So if you lose 10, 20, 30% on your top line pricing, there is just no way that you recover that with your manufacturing cost. The only strategy to protect margins in our business with our portfolio is with the new medicines. So we need a Tecentriq, we need a lampalizumab, we need Perjeta, hopefully in the early setting. We need emicizumab. This is how we keep the margins going in the long term. Now, irrespective of that, however, we had this very specific situation that we were running short of capacities in biologics and had overcapacities in small molecules. And as a result of that, we had to completely reshift our manufacturing network to close factories around the world on the small molecule side and concurrently heavily invest into capacities on the biologic side. And this is what you see reflected in the numbers. But I'm afraid that, of course, that helps. That is very important to keep cost under control, and the amounts as such are significant, but by no means can you offset the price erosion which comes from generics or from biosimilars. It needs the product pipeline to do that.
And you, along the same sort of theme, can you just help us then on what the CapEx should be over the next few years, whether we should keep it at the high level?
We've probably reached the peak here. Because we are now through with these big investments on the biologic side, so we have reached. How shall I say? I don't expect that this is going to increase further. We have seen some increase over the recent past, as you know, but I would assume we are at the peak. Would you support that, Alan?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that. When you look really at the structure that we have had in 2016, a lot was driven really by real capex. We also bought a little bit of real estate, which also brought that number up to 4.1 billion. I totally agree with you, Severin. That's the peak. But having said this, I think it's not like that we now fall off the cliff in the next years. So I think we perhaps stay at that level, perhaps a little bit of a reduction. And then really, after we've done the major programs in Basel, but also in San Francisco, I think I see it declining. But I think for the foreseeable future, we'll still be on a relatively high level.
You had your 4 billion or so, you had your PPE investment, and then you had another billion of effectively capitalized R&D, all of these little deals.
That's
correct, and relationships.
Correct.
And should we expect that level to continue to be, about a billion out a year? That was a big step up in 2016, so it's right, just to help us on the cash flow. And then I have only one pharma-related question.
Well, on the second one, it's more difficult to predict it because it's extremely opportunity-driven. And you can have relatively big items here. If you look at the BioNTech deal, this alone was over 300 million upfront, which is then capitalized. So you have two or three deals of that kind. And that's, by the way, the deals we continue to do. Early stage deals is a different story. Here, I think we can still generate a lot of value with these kind of partnerships. So it's opportunistic. It's true, last year we had probably more than the usual run rate. So from a pure statistical point of view, it's likely that it decreases. But then again, if really an interesting opportunity came up, we would still look at it.
And a final question, please, on if you could tell us a little bit more about your assumptions for biosimilar erosion. Perhaps you could tell us, the countries where you would expect in Europe the biosimilars to come in first for something like Herceptin, are they the markets where you've managed to do the biggest change to the subcutaneous formulation? We're just trying to think how we should consider that erosion rate, as we know that you've got some defences in place, but I guess of all of us, there's as many different erosion rates down as there are IO sales up.
Right. The fact is that we don't know it either. It will depend a lot on what the biosimilar companies will do, what strategies they will pursue. And I guess that's what we call competition. You have to react to new entrants, and we have to adjust our pricing strategies along the way. But I do believe that it will be a gradual uptake. And you mentioned some of the points. In certain countries, we have a good penetration with our sub-Q formulation. There might be completely different penetration rates in different settings of the diseases. We'll see how many competitors will come in how many countries. That will influence the dynamics. So our base assumption is that there will be a gradual erosion, which starts in the second half of 2017. We will see this accelerating into 2018, but we don't expect this to be a cliff at a certain point. There's also the geographic dimension, of course. It comes in two steps, first Europe and only later on in the United States. But I'm afraid I can't give you a specific number. And also in our internal plans, we have quite a range of possible scenarios and, as a result, possible answers to the strategies of our competitors.
And Joe, just to say that we just cannot do it from competitive reasons as well. I think suddenly we cannot go out and say what our basic assumptions, even if we had clear-cut assumptions here, we cannot indicate.
We wouldn't speak about our pricing strategy. We wouldn't do. But beyond that, it's also very difficult to see how the dynamics will evolve.
You must know, though, you've given us the percentage of conversion in Rituxan. You know, what proportion of that is now sub-Q? You just said there was more in Herceptin, but you haven't given us that number. I mean, maybe you could help us with...
What we see is in the countries where we launched sub-Q, actually the penetration is very good, but we didn't launch it in all the countries. And that has several reasons. Very often it's also a matter of incentive. How are the healthcare systems incentivized? In those countries where we launched, we had very good penetration. You want to add to that?
Yeah, could add. So we have published this.
If you use the mic.
It doesn't work. Yeah, no, does it work? It's approaching in Europe an average 50% conversion rate for Herceptin subcutaneous, which is a pretty rapid uptake if you just see that we launched it like 3 years ago, not even 3 years ago. And a similar pattern we see wherever we have launched Rituxan subcutaneous in the dynamics.
Right.
So when biosimilars come in, I would assume that roughly half of the market is switched.
Yeah, and we were actually surprised about the high penetration, but the reality is that infusion chairs and the time for nurses is really scarce in hospitals. So if you can help the healthcare system in this respect, this is embraced. We see that. But having said that, at the end of the day, we will still be under pressure for prices because there's not a clinical differentiation. This is really a convenience argument and, of course, to a certain degree, a cost-saving argument in the hospital. So I wouldn't like to talk it up either, I have to say. But so far, penetration has been good. Good. So time-wise, I think we're still fine. Okay, let's switch back to this side. Can we start here in the second row, and then I'll get back to you.
Hi, it's Tim Rice, Deutsche. Just following up on Joe's question on the Herceptin, in terms of net price that you and sort of incentives for conversion, what should we be assuming in Europe that you've actually to help that 50% rate? I'm pretty sure that it's not going at exactly the same price for the subcut on a net basis. Is that correct?
Sorry,
To get the 50% uptake in Europe, there's obviously volume-based agreements, etc. Have you been? What's the net price difference between that you've been offering to get?
No. There's no difference. So what happens is, if a hospital has a choice between sub-Q and IV, then there is an adoption rate of 50% for sub-Q. And the reason why this adoption is because it's just more convenient for the patient and it is much more efficient in the healthcare center. That's the reason why you have the uptake. However, having said that, there are certain countries where physicians are incentivized for IV because they get paid for every infusion. And in those countries, of course, the uptake is different to countries where this doesn't matter. So that's what I meant with incentives. But we don't give an incentive from a pricing point of view. It's the same price.
Okay, so no volume agreements to get
it's the same price.
Okay.
Same price, yeah.
Okay. Then just question for Alan in terms of the 1467 and the guidance for broadly in line with sales. What do we mean by broadly? Could that be 0 to 1% earnings growth? And will 1467 still be remembered this time next year? I don't mean to be flippant about that, but I remember 1385 this time last year in terms of the base.
Yeah, because we had a different impact, you know, from currencies. I think that's the whole reason for it. We had a much larger impact. You know, therefore, I think the 1467 is the right basis for you, as outlined. I think really according to the methodology that we apply normally, which evidently was not so present last year. You know, that's why I mentioned it. So I think that's the basis. That's the basis you have to focus and build your expectations on. And then we can wildly discuss what broadly really means. Yeah. I know a lot of companies have used broadly, not just for core EPS growth as we did, but also for sales, when I remember it well. So I think there is a common understanding on the market, I guess, what that roughly means and what that represents. And certainly we will stick to market expectations in that sense.
Okay, and then just finally another question on tax.
But just to be absolutely sure, broadly does not refer to currencies. So this is clean of currencies. Our guidance is clean of currencies. So we are not, we see this at constant rates, irrespective of currency.
Yeah. I think we have to move on.
No, just that we don't have a misunderstanding here. So our guidance is at constant rates, as always. Right. You had a second question.
I was just going to add on tax, just to help understand the relative basis.
You have to look at time.
If US tax laws do change, I know that there are various offsets, but given your manufacturing presence and given your share of US market, do you think relative to other European pharma companies, you would be a net winner on a relative basis from US?
I think I gave that answer already. I think I'm not starting to speculate about that. You know, we have a U.S. manufacturing tax credit. You know, we have a U.S. R&D credit. Yeah? So I think really we are privileged from that sense. Yeah? Well, like anybody else in the industry, but I think there are certain, how should I say it, incentives already in the market. And as I've said, I think, we can all assume that tax rates just go down. But what you normally experience, as I described with Switzerland, it's exactly the situation that tax rates might go down and then certain benefits are going away. And I think that's a little bit how we think about the structure in the US in the future. And just to give you one point, I think, which is pretty unusual, I think, personally, is really the deductibility of interest expenses, which is not limited in the US. You will find in a lot of other countries that this is limited. Not limited in the US. So I think there are lots of elements in here, and we have to look really at the whole package at the very end. And then let's see, and hopefully there is some benefit for us in it, but I have to see it first to really believe it.
Right. Let's turn back to this corner for two more questions, if you can keep the questions. 1 minute left. Okay, keep it very short. I'll keep my answer short if I can. Good.
I'll try. So just on your 3-year to 5-year outlook, when you say more of an offset and then manage through, we've talked about Affinity and the kind of $300 million delta for this year on neoadjuvant use. But how important is Affinity to the beyond 17 to maintaining the Herceptin or the HER2 franchise when you're talking about managing through? So if Affinity is positive, do you believe you can more than offset with growth? And then secondly, on the kind of growth side, Dan's comments were about further discrimination within the IO products. Can you maybe talk about whether that's your thoughts on the trial designs that you have, the data that you're generating, Tecentriq specific, or you think there will be a, particularly in the lung cancer setting, a differentiation between PD-L1 versus PD-1, and whether that ties into your managing through and growth?
Well, so I'll keep the answer on the second one very short. It will depend on the data. We'll see as the data evolves. We had so many surprises here with our own data, with the data we saw of competitors. So let's wait for the data.
But it's the fact he said that he felt there was going to be further discrimination. That implied that he was seeing something on your products that were going to make it different to the others.
Well, I mean, look back for Tecentriq, second line lung. We thought we developed this product for a stratified patient population, and it turned out to be differentiated versus the competition because It can be used for any status, PD-L1 positive, PD-L1 negative, smokers, non-smokers, squamous, non-squamous. So suddenly it turned out to be differentiated. But I tell you, beforehand, we had a completely different hypothesis. This is also why Tecentriq did better last year than we originally expected, because the data were different than we expected ourselves. So now as we get into the next round of data for first-line lung cancer, combinations with chemo, combinations with chemo and Avastin, combinations of immunotherapies. We'll see how the data play out, and we'll see whether the PD-1s or the PD-L1s do better, what kind of combinations do better. It's really depending on the data. Let me just give you me a chance to answer on your first question regarding affinity. Now, affinity, of course, is important, there's no doubt. If you look at Herceptin, a third of the market is metastatic, two-thirds of the market is early. We are approaching 2 billion for Perjeta in the metastatic setting. So, you know, on the back of an envelope, you can make a calculation how significant the potential is from a positive affinity readout. And in this sense, of course, it helps. The point which we tried to make today is that affinity is not the only one. I mean, elampalizumab is a multi-billion product if the data are differentiated. Hemophilia is a multi-billion segment. And then, of course, on top we have cancer immunotherapies, and we will learn a lot during this year. So just over the next couple of months, we will have some really, really big readouts. Depending on the results, of course, we'll see more or less growth. That's how it is. I say this all with an optimistic tone, but I really don't know how it will read out. I really don't know. We are all double blinded. We have to. Okay. Good. I think we have 2 minutes or so to change the rooms. And it was again. And it's all on this floor, right?
Yeah, that's how you do it.
Okay, good. Thank you very much.